Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. My name is Mary Rose Papandrea. I'm a constitutional law professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm really excited to be here today to discuss with this wonderful group of lawyers the prosecution of Julian Assange and its impact on press freedoms. The panelists I have here today, to my immediate right, Bed Wiesner, who's a longtime ACLU lawyer. He's also the lawyer for Edward Snowden. These bios will be very brief, so we can just get right to it. Next to Ben, we have Jamil Jaffer. He is the director of the Knight Foundation's First Amendment Institute at Columbia, New York. And next to Jamil, we have Amy Jeffress. She's a partner at Arnold & Porter, and a former assistant U.S. attorney, but also a lawyer at Department of Justice, and she also worked at the embassy, the U.S. Embassy in London. So thank you all for coming. They nominated me to give an introduction, so thank you, panelists. So I will give a brief introduction to the prosecution, just so you all know what the prosecution is all about, to serve as a foundation for our conversation. So Julian Assange, as I'm assuming you all know, is the founder of WikiLeaks. And for at least the last 10 years, the U.S. government has been investigating his collection and dissemination of U.S. national security information. The Obama administration considered prosecuting Assange, but never did. In March 2018, the Department of Justice, under the Trump administration, announced an indictment coming out of the Eastern District of Virginia. This indictment had charges focusing on his collection, encouragement of Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, to disseminate, to give him information. And in this indictment, the government alleged that he had actively solicited and received classified information, that it was an overwhelming amount of classified information involving Afghanistan and Iraq war, significant activity reports, State Department cables, and Guantanamo Bay assessment briefs, and that this conspiracy to obtain this information was achieved by using online chat services, by scrubbing Manning's ID so that he would not be identifiable, and by using a secure Dropbox to receive the documents. And the indictment also contained charges under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, alleging that Assange had provided part of a password to get into the Department of Justice computers, although they never did, in fact, get into the computers using that password. Now, if that weren't enough of a threat to press freedom, and we'll talk on the panel whether that alone, that indictment alone was a threat to press freedom, the government then announced in May 2019 a superseding indictment that expressly added Espionage Act charges against Assange for publishing information. So the publication charges were not in the original indictment. And the government, in announcing this superseding indictment, went out of its way to say they were not going after a journalist because Julian Assange is no journalist. The government also emphasized that it was not prosecuting Julian Assange for publishing all of those many thousands of documents that it received from Manning, but specifically the names of human intelligence sources that, in the government's allegations, posed a grave threat to national security and to their health and safety. So now we're going to explore the ramifications of this prosecution. Before we get into the statutory and constitutional and public policy concerns, I thought I'd ask Amy, if you don't mind, just to give us some background on the status of the extradition, because, of course, unless Julian Assange is extradited here, there will be no prosecution.
Right. So the status of the extradition is that he has had hearings begin in the United Kingdom, and that process will go on for some time. There is an extradition treaty between the U.S. and the U.K., but extradition law in the United Kingdom is fairly complicated. And unlike in the United States, where there are very few arguments that you can make to resist extradition, there are many, many arguments that you can make in the United Kingdom, and the courts often take years to resolve these cases. The position that I had at the embassy that Mary Rose mentioned was the Department of Justice attaché to the U.S. Embassy, and one of my responsibilities was handling extradition requests. requests. And there was one extradition that was completed while I was there that had been pending for 13 years. So I don't mean to make you panic, Barry, but it could take a long time. And that one was unusual. That one was a terrorist suspect who had appealed all the way through the UK courts and also into through the European Court of Human Rights. But Julian Assange could very well avail himself of the same courts, and it could be very long time before that proceeding is completed. There are also a number of defenses. I don't know if you want me to go into that
just
now.
Just briefly, I think it'd be helpful. Sure.
Sure. So the extradition treaty prohibits extradition of anyone charged with a political offense, and that's not defined particularly specifically in the treaty, so it's going to be a matter for the UK courts to decide if they think that this indictment is does charge political offenses. They are not on their face political offenses. In other words, these charges could apply to many situations that are not political, but one of the pieces of the definition that is in the treaty is whether it's politically motivated, and that will certainly be something that the UK courts will look at. So that's certainly one issue, and I would guess that that would be the predominant argument that they would make, but there are several others. The UK has what they call a forum bar, which means that you can also argue that it would be improper to transfer you to another country for prosecution because it would be more appropriate to be prosecuted in the United Kingdom. And then there's a complicated sort of list of eight factors that have to be analyzed under that test. But that is another potential defense to extradition. I think it's a bit more difficult for Julian Assange to make that argument, given that he's an Australian citizen, and the United Kingdom might not have an interest in prosecuting him, given that the subject of the WikiLeaks disclosures were U.S. documents. But there are a number of factors that would apply to him, given that he had been resident in the United Kingdom, and that's where he was arrested and so forth. So that that would be another potential argument that that he could make.
What about the recent revelations that the U.S. was spying on him while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy and perhaps overhearing conversations he had with his lawyers?
Right. And just to be clear, I don't know anything about that factually, whether
sure.
that did or didn't happen, but assuming that those allegations, that they can prove those allegations, I think that that would also be something that the UK courts would hear, and in particular, whether that activity would be a violation of his human rights, because it's against the UK's Human Rights Act of 1998 to violate someone's human rights, and that argument has been made successfully in a number of cases to defeat extradition as well.
Great, thank you. Jamil, I was wondering if you could give us your thoughts on why we're seeing this prosecution now. And one thing I didn't mention in my opening remarks is that it is based on activities from almost a decade ago. And as I did say, the Obama administration had been investigating and decided for whatever reason not to prosecute. Do you have any thoughts? And I recognize it's probably rampant speculation, but
yeah,
I have
rampant speculation, sure. I can imagine a few different things. So one is that the Trump administration has been attacking press freedom in a variety of very visible ways and trying to narrow the space for investigative journalism and national security journalism in a variety of ways. There is obviously the routine labeling of critical journalism as fake news. There's the attaching the label of enemy of the people to journalists who cover the administration in ways that the administration believes are unfair. And then much more sinister things like the administration's, at the very least, participation in the cover-up of Jamal Khashoggi's murder. And, against that background, I think it's natural to see this indictment as part of a broader pattern meant to narrow the space for national security journalism and, more generally, narrow the space for press freedom. So that's, you know, that may be part of the explanation for why this indictment was filed when it was filed. You know, they, as you noted, there was a earlier indictment which focused on the CFAA, and I think it would have been relatively easy for the administration to persuade the UK to extradite Assange to face prosecution on those charges. The Justice Department surely knew that filing this superseding indictment would complicate the extradition request pretty dramatically. Maybe they saw that as a benefit, and maybe, you know, if they did see it as a benefit, then the way to think about this indictment is it's not really about Assange at all. It's really meant as a message to journalists. That's the value of the indictment to the administration. You know, all that is speculation, but I tend to believe that it's well-founded speculation. I think that the Trump administration saw an opportunity to deter journalism that it viewed as inconvenient, and Assange was the vehicle for that message of deterrence. All of that under the umbrella of rampant speculation.
Can I speculate?
Of course, I would like to speculate, Ram.
I'm jealous.
Yes.
I think, you know, when we say the Trump administration made the decision to prosecute and the Obama administration made the decision not to, that can obscure what probably is going on behind the scenes. It was under the Obama administration that a criminal grand jury was stood up for years on end, and there were plainly many people working in government under the Obama administration who wanted to see these charges brought. They were in the FBI, they were in the Department of Justice. At the end of the day, when the Attorney General was Eric Holder, he made a decision, as he explained to the Washington Post, that he didn't see a clear and principled way to bring charges against Assange that would not also sweep in the kind of investigative journalism that is done by the Washington Post, by many other what we would consider mainstream U.S. news outlets. But that doesn't mean that there weren't lots of people in government who were pushing for this to happen. And then when you replace the Attorney General with someone like Jeff Sessions, who had long wanted to see investigations of journalists for publishing classified information, Barr, who said in his confirmation hearing he could see prosecuting journalists in some circumstances for publishing national security information, that's the difference. Is that the faction that wanted these charges to go forward is now supported by the Attorney General and by the President, whereas in the past there was some check on
this. Ben, I appreciate those insights. One of the things we also should keep in mind is that leak prosecutions really took off under the Obama administration. So before we all condemn Trump and Republicans as being the only ones who are threatening national security reporting, I think we should recognize that leak prosecutions have dramatically increased. And of course, it is a priority. As the Department of Justice said in the press release of the Julian Assange indictment, they said specifically it is a priority of the department to go after leaks. And they said, and this is our fifth prosecution, and we are really excited about it. So definitely it's important to keep in mind that whole context. Amy, I know when we had our prep call, you had some interesting thoughts on what you saw in the indictment, maybe some tensions within the department that you thought might be revealed from that, even just in the first indictment.
Right. This is also
rampant speculation.
But based perhaps on just looking at the dates and when the various steps were taken. So just to be clear, when I was in government when these disclosures were made, and just want to make sure everyone knows I was not involved at all in the discussions about the prosecution. I had moved to London in 2010 before the WikiLeaks disclosures and was in the embassy, helping the embassy deal with that, but not discussing the prosecution. And I had worked for Holder, so I also wanted to be clear, this is not based on my knowledge of any of those discussions other than what has been reported in the press and general gossip. So, but if you look at the indictment, and this goes back to what Ben was just saying, there were clearly discussions and there was investigative activity during the Obama administration. And while I know what Eric Holder's said about that, there were clearly people who were pushing for charges to be brought. And my just sense from when that first indictment was issued, which was March 6th of 2018, which is 2 days before the sort of eight-year, if they used an eight-year statute of limitations, which would be 5 years plus 3 years if you have a mutual legal assistance request, there was a significant communication between Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange on March 8th, and that timing makes me think that they were running up a statute of limitations. And so somebody was pushing for an indictment, and they decided to go ahead and bring it when they had a potential statute of limitations issue coming up. And that ran in the Trump administration. So I can't say whether there would have been a lot of people who were really pressing the DOJ hard to indict if those forces wouldn't have won had they faced a statute of limitations, even when Holder or Loretta Lynch were still attorney general. I don't think we know that. Clearly, given the disclosures in the indictment, you can imagine there are a lot of people in the Defense Department and law enforcement and intelligence community who would be very very much in favor of bringing it. So that's just a little gloss on the timing issues.
I thought it was interesting as I was reviewing the original indictment for this panel that the it didn't charge him with the publication of the information under the Espionage Act. It was all about a conspiracy to get information from Manning that would in violation of the Espionage Act. In other words, the Espionage Act also prohibits the disclosure of this information. So you see that tension, I think, in that original indictment right off the bat. So I want to tear apart the superseding indictment and focus on two different buckets of charges. One is on the sort of conspiracy to get the information, the encouragement of getting Manning to reveal the information, and then the charges about publication. So maybe just start first with the charges under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and then the solicitation. And Ben, could you talk about what the maybe just if you want to add something about what the charges are? And then
I think the first indictment, which charged conspiracy under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, was somewhat incoherent. And the only way that it made sense was that it was an attempt to bring charges against Assange, trigger an extradition requirement without charging him for publication, which would have been seen as a Rubicon by many people in not just the free speech community, but in the media. And they, you know, obviously revisited that shortly afterwards. But the theory behind the computer fraud and abuse charge was that Manning, in obtaining the materials to provide to WikiLeaks, had exceeded her authorized access to a government database in violation of federal law, and that Assange had conspired with Manning to assist her in exceeding her authorized access by providing a hash or a password. As you pointed out in the introduction, it turns out that that actually had nothing to do with the documents that Manning provided to Assange. So this is somewhat of a weak charge factually and legally, but that was the theory behind that charge. And it was attractive to a lot of people because it allowed people in the media to say, well, I wouldn't do that, right? Sure, I talk to sources, I might encourage them to give me information, but I would never help them crack a password. This is not a threat to press freedom. If we just stop here and say the real criminal charge was not the publication, it wasn't the communication, it was helping Manning to crack a password to get classified information. Here's how we can put Assange on this side of the line and put basically the rest of the press on this side of the line. And sure, if you talk to reporters, they would mostly say, yeah, I probably would not help a source crack a password, you know, in that way. Of course, that distinction collapsed pretty soon afterwards when the government brought all the charges under the Espionage Act. But I think it's worth stating here that since it's a crime for someone who works in government who has a security clearance to provide national defense information to someone who is not authorized to receive it, national security journalism, investigative journalism, looks a lot like a criminal conspiracy. Because what your job is as a national security reporter is to go to someone who has that access and to persuade that person to commit a felony by sharing that information with you so that you can then share it with the public in violation of the Espionage Act and other statutes, right? That is a conspiracy, right? You are entering into a relationship with someone in order to persuade them to break the law. We have never consider that a crime when journalists do it for good reason, which is that if we only knew what the government wanted us to know, and if classification held, and if journalists didn't persuade sources to provide classified information, we would only have the government's version of events on the most important issues of our time. And so that's really why this is such a dangerous set of charges, right? So, yes, Assange urged, cajoled, persuaded, charmed, beguiled, tried to get Manning to provide more information. But if you think about the way that a Bart Gellman or a Cy Hirsch or one of these other, or a Jane Mayer or a Dana Priest, how they work with sources over years, how they cultivate them over a decade, and are always kind of pushing, prodding, what can you tell me about this? I heard about this. What do you know about that? It becomes extremely difficult to find a way, in an abstract way, distinguish what Assange did with Manning on that basis from what national security journalists do every day.
Right, and it does make it legally challenging to make to mount a defense when the courts have drawn this bright line distinction between leakers and third-party publishers, where the Supreme Court precedent is very negative, and lower courts really haven't been too willing to listen to First Amendment defenses brought by leakers. And so if you have a conspiracy to leak, then it's harder to defend versus...
Well, we should get into whether it's the courts that have drawn that bright line, because I'm not so sure. I actually think it's really mainly been the practice and tradition of prosecutors.
There are some pretty... Right. Well, we can get into that. I don't know if we'll focus as much on the leakers, per se, but I just highlight that the aiding and abetting a leak might be legally more challenging versus the publication, and maybe a clever threading of the needle. Jamil, I was wondering if you wanted to flesh out how national security reporting works. I mean, some of the things in the indictment, using a Dropbox, concealing the identity, if you just speak a little bit more to how this maps onto what mainstream journalists do.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ben, you know, has already started to describe that, but if you talk to national security journalists about how they get information and how they relate to their sources, how they interact with their sources, what they describe is something very similar to what's described in the indictment. That's what makes the indictment so problematic. The Justice Department said and says that nobody needs to worry about press freedom here because Julian Assange isn't a journalist and WikiLeaks isn't the press. But whatever you think the right answers are to those questions, whether Assange is a journalist or not, and whether WikiLeaks should be considered the press, it's a fact that the indictment describes the activities that journalists engage in every day. Soliciting information from sources, communicating on encrypted channels, using Dropboxes to share information. These are the things that journalists do. These are the kinds of things that we expect journalists to do, and if they didn't do them, they would be considered to be engaged in a kind of journalistic malpractice. So to me, it seems entirely beside the point, this question of whether Assange is a journalist or not. The indictment is an effort to criminalize journalistic activity, and that's what makes it problematic. I just wanted to add a footnote to something that was said earlier about the CFAA charges in the first indictment. I do think that a lot of journalists looked at that and they thought, that's not me. I don't violate the CFAA, and more generally, I don't violate the law in order to do the kind of journalism I do. It is actually a little bit more complicated than that. A lot of journalism today, especially digital journalism, involves violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We represent some journalists who investigate the social media platforms in part by using digital tools that some people say violate the terms of service. And violations of terms of service are violations of the CFAA, prosecutable violations of the CFAA. And so I do think that, generally, yes, the first indictment did kind of draw a line between Assange and most journalists, but it's a little bit messier than I think most people realize even at the time.
I know the mainstream media does really like to try to distance itself. Is there anything that is different? You know, I think in the indictment and in some of the public announcements, the government will emphasize that Assange is like actively soliciting, you know, give me everything, give me all your classified information. Is that different in compared to what journalists do in what way?
Jack Goldsmith had a really interesting piece about this on Lawfare. Were you going to say that? Where he tried to write, he wrote an essay saying, how different is WikiLeaks from all of these newspapers that all now use SecureDrop, which is a tool that is designed to allow people to make anonymous encrypted submissions of classified information, right? So that is a active solicitation. If you go to the New York Times website, if you go to the Washington Post website, if you go to the New Yorker's website, you will find a portal where they're essentially saying, you have secrets, you want to share them confidentially, come to us. Now, WikiLeaks innovated that, but these other institutions have copied it.
I saw in the indictment something, I think it was a footnote that said that WikiLeaks had changed its website at some point to say, we are not soliciting this information, but we will receive it, or something like that, which I thought was an interesting,
right.
Perhaps
I mean,
they had lawyers telling them, don't actively solicit. I thought that was kind of
maybe
curious.
You can draw a distinction between a secure drop and more affirmative solicitation, but it is a very thin line, thin line between what the government is saying is criminal here and what media organizations do every day.
Yeah, there was a prosecution also out of the Eastern District of Virginia that ended up folding, but it was against some lobbyists from the AIPAC organization, and it was similarly included charges about aiding and abetting leaks. And I believe the allegations were things like providing a fax machine and baseball tickets, that sort of thing. So I'm not sure that there's any sort of resolution on what would be enough to be considered aiding and abetting. You know, what is it? If, I mean, providing an outlet or a place to give the documents, if that's alone enough, certainly most journalists would be swept in that.
I'll just circle back to the extradition point to follow up on this discussion about the distinction between the two indictments. When the first indictment came out relating to the computer fraud and abuse charges, it seemed to me that that was a stronger indictment for purposes of extradition because it did not get into the offenses that open up the the arguments for a political offense. There have been plenty of extradition requests over hacking cases, and those have gone through the UK courts successfully for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part. So that would have been a safer extradition indictment, but I think Ben pointed out that there was a factual weakness there where that attempt to crack using the password didn't actually work. So I don't know if the government then thought that that was factually too weak to bring, and then, maybe they were always intending to bring the superseding indictment in any event, but I do think the superseding indictment has a lot of risk on the extradition front that the initial indictment did not.
Great, thank you. So now I want to drill down more on the government's claim that it's not going after journalists, and I thought first we'd look at the relevant statutes quickly and then talk about the First Amendment. So first, on a statutory front, Ben? If you want to start, anyone could take a stab at this just for the audience's benefit. Is there anything in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or the Espionage Act or any other statutes that are at play here that distinguish between journalists and non-journalists or disclosures to the press versus disclosures to our enemies? Can you just, for the audience's benefit, explain whether there is anything like that in the statutes?
I mean, at the broadest level, the answer to your question is no. On its face, the Espionage Act makes it a felony for someone who holds a security clearance to provide national defense information to anyone who is not authorized to receive it. That would cover someone in the NSA selling NSA spy tools to the Chinese military, and that covers Barton Gellman and Marty Baron publishing in the New York Times a front page story about the PRISM program. In both cases, it is disseminating information to people who are not authorized to receive it. I said someone who has a security clearance. The law actually does not even include that requirement. That's been the practice, right? So on its face, there's no exemption for the secondary disclosure that the journalists make.
Or even subsequent disclosures.
Or even subsequent disclosures after that, right?
Right. So, for example, if, Ben, did you just say PRISM, right?
Yeah.
So technically, you know, Ben has disclosed classified information.
Disseminated,
in,
yes.
Yeah, in violation of the Espionage Act.
Right.
That's the breadth of the act.
Are there any other provisions in the Espionage Act that might help protect journalists?
I mean, I would say one of you mentioned, I think it was you, Jamil, mentioned that it's really practice as opposed to, I think when you were talking about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how broad that can apply in terms of violations of terms of service. I mean, many of us probably violate the terms of service of various social media that we use all the time without even realizing that. And so for the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to criminalize the violation of the terms of service is incredibly overbroad. I think most of us who our criminal defense lawyers recognize that the criminal laws are incredibly overbroad in, you know, a million ways, and you do rely on prosecutors to exercise discretion not to bring cases where there isn't criminal intent and, you know, facts that really warrant prosecution. So I think you're largely relying on practice and, you know, prosecutors doing what's right and not, you know, the strict requirements of statutes, which are often very easy to meet.
So. Another just point about practice. We're now talking about whether these laws can be applied to publishers. These laws were never even applied to leakers, to the press, successfully until the 1980s, even though the Espionage Act is from 1917. And in the late 1970s, the CIA General Counsel testified in Congress that, to his mind, it was not established that the Espionage Act covered leaks to the press. If it did, in his words, there has been in this town an unprecedented crime wave stretching back decades. Right? Because surely every day, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of these felonies are being committed. This is how it runs. So the first conviction of even a leaker to the press was Samuel Morrison in 1984. Now it's very established, at least in the lower courts, that the Espionage Act not only applies to leakers, but applies in a basically strict liability way, that courts don't even review whether the information was properly classified. They just defer to the government on that question. And now we've reached the point where we're asking the much more consequential question, does it apply to someone who didn't even have any obligation to preserve the secret in the first place?
And well, even... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I would challenge that a bit. I actually think that I'll walk back what I just said, because I actually think that the Espionage Act is narrower. Not all leaks are prosecutable. The vast majority of leaks don't involve classified information at all, but there are also very specific categories of classified information that can be prosecuted under those statutes, and I don't think the government can get away with just saying, I don't think the courts would accept that.
No. Yeah. The term, except for signals intelligence, it doesn't use the term classified information.
No,
it uses
exactly.
The term national defense information,
and
which is pretty broad.
Yeah.
Right, government officials have said before Congress, we're good with the statutes we have. We can go after pretty much everything we want to go after.
Yeah. There's an awful lot of classified information that would never even, that would never come anywhere near being national defense information, though, I can say. There's just such over-classification.
Just as a matter of prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's just a lot of classified information that shouldn't even be classified. There's a ton of State Department information. Everything a foreign leader ever says to anybody is classified, and that's not national defense, really.
I
so,
agree.
Yeah.
The question is, under the law, who makes that decision?
Right, yeah. I was just asking about the statute itself.
Yeah.
And just to finish the statutory conversation, is there anything in the statute that requires a showing of harm that's been caused by the disclosure, or is there a requirement of a showing of a bad motive for the disclosure?
No, there's not that, I don't think. Yeah.
The answer is
no. There have been some efforts to persuade courts to impose those kinds of requirements, and the efforts have entirely failed.
Great. So, Jamil, sticking with you, I want to turn now to the First Amendment argument. Can you tell us why Pentagon Papers doesn't resolve this in Julian Assange's favor? Great press victory. why is that not the answer here?
So the Pentagon Papers case involved the New York Times, a publisher that, and the Washington Post that published excerpts from a classified defense study of the Vietnam War. And the court says that the Justice Department isn't entitled to an injunction against publication. And that's regarded as a pillar of First Amendment law, and I think rightly regarded as a pillar of First Amendment law, but it involved two things are important about the case. One is it involved a prior restraint and not mm-hmm. criminal penalties imposed mm-hmm. after the fact. Mm-hmm. And some of the opinions in the case suggest that maybe the court might have thought differently about the imposition of criminal penalties on the New York Times or the Washington Post had they been imposed after the publication. And the second difference, maybe even more important, is that the Times was not alleged to have participated in any way in the actual leaking of the classified information. The Times was, effectively received the information over the transom and participated at arm's length in the publication. Then published it sort of at arm's length from the. From the leaker.
In the movie, it just showed up on the table.
Right, right, right. In subsequent cases, the court has said more about this this arm's length relationship and to what extent this arm's length relationship is required in order to receive the protection of the First Amendment, right? So there's a case called Bartnicki, which is about 25 years old now, I guess, in which a radio station broadcast a conversation that had been intercepted by somebody else. And the court, as in the Pentagon Papers case, held that, this was a criminal penalty case, not a prior restraint case, but the court held that the radio station couldn't be punished. But in holding that the radio station couldn't be punished, the court said, it's important here that the radio station didn't participate in the illegality. It was a stranger to the illegality, a stranger to the wiretapping of the conversation. And the court really hasn't filled in any details about what kinds of conduct would constitute participation in illegality sufficient to deprive you of protection that you would otherwise have under the First Amendment. And that gray area is what makes this conversation necessary, right? If the Supreme Court had held that soliciting classified information is protected by the First Amendment, if that were clear from First Amendment decisions, then the message of this kind of indictment would be less troubling because there would be that protection to fall back on. But there really is a lot of uncertainty about how far the First Amendment's protection goes with respect to the kinds of activities that are described in the indictment. And that's why journalists, or at least some journalists, see this indictment as a threat.
And Jamil, sticking with you for a minute, but then I'll invite the panelists to hop in. Just to clarify, was the Pentagon Papers case, did it rest on the press clause, or is it only applicable to people who can be called journalists?
Basically nothing in American law rests on the press clause. The press clause has been read out of the First Amendment almost entirely. There's some consequences to that. Some are good and some are bad. One consequence is that the courts don't generally care very much whether the person invoking the First Amendment is a journalist or isn't a journalist. The courts don't get into this analysis of whether the litigant or the defendant is a journalist or not. Nothing turns on it. And that's what gives, bloggers the ability to rely on the First Amendment when they publish the kinds of things that are ordinarily published by the New York Times or the Washington Post. And that's probably a great thing that it's not just the Times and the Post that can rely on the First Amendment. But it may also be true that the courts have been less willing to extend protection to publication because extending protection to publication would mean extending protection to everybody, not just to some discrete class of journalists and mainstream publishers.
Right. Next question was for you. So do you think that the we talked a little bit earlier about the tension with the mainstream or traditional journalists and WikiLeaks. I know I go to some conferences with media lawyers all the time, and there's often a distancing. We talked about how the first indictment, a lot of media people are, oh, that would never happen to me. I'm not like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Do you think it would be beneficial for the traditional journalists to try to argue for the press clause to be given meaning, for there to be special protections for journalists? And if so, how would the court go about defining journalists?
I think it'd be very difficult for the courts to define journalists. I think there would be it would be a perilous endeavor. You would end up with this privileged class of journalists that have the ability to report on sensitive issues of the kind that the indictment describes, and nobody else would be able to rely on the First Amendment to report on those kinds of issues. And I can't imagine that would work out well. This is a little bit of a digression, but I mentioned earlier these CFAA cases that we've been working on, where we represent journalists reporting on the social media companies, and we proposed to Facebook at one point that Facebook adopt a kind of safe harbor that would allow journalists to use tools that would otherwise violate the terms of service. And when we were proposing the safe harbor, we thought through, how are we going to describe the outer limits of the safe harbor? Are we going to say journalists can rely on this safe harbor, but no one else can? And it was tempting to go down that road. It would have resulted in more space for our own clients to engage in the kinds of investigations that they want to engage in. But ultimately, we couldn't justify privileging this, this small class. And instead, what we tried to do was define journalistic activity, define the categories of activities that might entitle you to protection under the safe harbor. But if that's the road you go down, more generally, if that's the road that the Supreme Court goes down, then an indictment like this becomes, even more chilling, because as we were discussing earlier, the activities described in the indictment are in fact journalistic activities. These are the activities that journalists engage in. And so you have no line separating Julian Assange here from Charlie Savage or Ellen Nakashima. They're all engaged in the same activities, and the label journalist doesn't matter at all.
The context where this does come up, and I think you're more of an expert on this than we are, is the 40 or so states that have shield laws for reporters who are, in some circumstances, are allowed to not have to turn over their confidential sources, whereas ordinary citizens would have to. And I think that the states, if I understand it right, I'm not an expert here, have used very different definitions of what a journalist is and what journalistic activity is. We don't have a federal shield law, so we don't have sort of national case law on this question. But there are contexts where at least legislatures have wrestled with this, the challenge of having to say, are there contexts where we want to say that these entities called journalists don't have to participate in legal process the way that ordinary citizens would? And I think there are actually some benefits to doing that. I think, there's another real challenge that this prosecution creates that we haven't gotten to, and maybe you were going to get there, another challenge to journalism, which is that Julian Assange, as was said earlier, is Australian. And the theory of the U.S. government's prosecution is that United States secrecy law applies to an Australian journalist working overseas to the point where he can be put in a U.S. prison if he publishes U.S. secrets. And if you look at some of the reporting of the last 2 months, where the New York Times, The Intercept, and others have gotten troves of top secret information from the highest reaches of the Chinese and Iranian governments, it's not hard to imagine
that both in Iran and in China, there are laws that make it a felony, a serious felony, to publish the top secret documents from those governments. Certainly, if an Iranian journalist tried to publish that in Iran, she or he would be in prison. If a Chinese journalist tried to do that in China, they'd be lucky to be in prison. But if China or Iran sought the extradition of the New York Times reporters who published this on the grounds that they violated Chinese or Iranian secrecy law, we would say that doesn't make any sense. I mean, we would be incredulous. We'd be dumbfounded. And yet no one has brought in that dimension here. You know, on what basis do we hold ourselves up to be able to say, you know, our secrecy law governs the entire world, and if are we willing to accept the principle of reciprocity here and say that American journalists can be prosecuted in foreign jurisdictions for publishing those countries' secrets? And I really think we need to elevate that threat as well that this prosecution presents.
And Ben, I should have mentioned that earlier in the extradition discussion because that is an issue, and there's a specific provision of the treaty that relates to extraterritorial application of offenses, and that's going to be another argument in the extradition proceeding, I'm sure.
Oh, that's really great. Thanks for adding that. I did want to flesh out there, to the extent that some lower courts have recognized a privilege, a reporter's privilege, yeah, under the First Amendment, they've embraced a standard that would probably apply to, would definitely apply to Julian Assange, which is an intent to disseminate standard, so that if at the time you received the information you intended to disseminate to the public, I think probably more than anyone he would qualify for that because he intended to disseminate everything that he received. I mean, initially he redacted and then later just everything went out. So, it depending on, as Jamil was saying, some statutes and the statutory shield laws use like number of hours you spend or if you make money, mm-hmm, right, that sort of thing. But these functional tests, the functional test that says the intent to disseminate would cover him, some scholars have said it should be if you follow journalistic standards. What's wrong with that? Why not say, if you follow sort of the canon of journalistic ethics? And the argument here would be, well, by not redacting out these sources' names, which is what the other, other traditional news organizations did, Assange did not follow journalistic ethics. So why not have that standard or maybe a responsible press standard? That sounds nice. Responsible press. You get the protection.
Remember that in order, under the executive order governing classification, in order for the government to classify information, a government official has to assert that the disclosure of this information would cause harm to the security of the nation. Now, we know that a huge percentage of what's classified should not be classified, but that assertion has already been made. So where would a court say that that publication of material that a national security official has said would harm the nation still comports with some kind of standard of ethics that supersedes that decision? I just don't see how that would be a workable
framework.
Yeah,
and it never
framework happens
right. In FOIA litigation, for example, when litigants go to court to try to force the government to disclose classified information. You know, we have this fight before judges all the time where the government is saying this would violate national security, and litigants, plaintiffs are saying there's a public interest in this information and its disclosure wouldn't jeopardize national security. And it is exceedingly rare that courts side with the plaintiffs who want the disclosure of classified information. So I think you'd be putting a lot of power in the hands of the government if that were the system. And also, this is not one thing. Journalistic ethics, it's not always obvious what journalistic ethics require in any particular instance. You know, when the New York Times reported the SWIFT program, which is this financial surveillance program, a lot of government officials said that this was irresponsible and jeopardized national security and couldn't understand why the Times had done it. And in fact, some journalists at other media organizations said similar things, said, this, you can't justify the disclosure of this this program. The same was true when the AP reported about this foiled bomb plot in Yemen, the government again said, you know, you've jeopardized national security, said it much more forcefully than I'm saying it now. And some other media organizations said, I'm not sure, you should have disclosed this. You know, and the truth is that these things involve judgment calls, and just saying people should use journalistic ethics doesn't actually resolve the question of how much should be disclosed and in what, you know, in what context.
Well, but Jamil, so the government made that argument in the Pentagon Papers case, and the judges, Judge Gazelle, who I clerked for, rejected mm-hmm. that and said, no, this is not national security information, and this is in the public interest, and no prior restraint. Out it goes.
Yes.
So,
but that case was unique, or almost unique, in that the Times and the Post already had the information, right?
Yeah.
And all these FOIA yeah. cases are not,
yeah,
you know,
no, that's
none
true.
Of that kind.
That's true.
You know, but the other, yeah, even with respect to the you know, human names of human sources, you know, I'm not going to defend Assange's decision not to redact those names. From what I know, I think that was the wrong decision. But there are circumstances in which disclosing the names of human sources, I think, would be justified journalistically. You can imagine a situation where, you know, the human source is thought to have given inaccurate information, and the inaccurate information led to, you know, bad consequences of one kind or another. You could dream up a million different circumstances in which the disclosure of the names of human sources would be journalistically justified. And, you know, putting it in the hands of judges and prosecutors to, you know, make calls about what's journalistically justified or not, it would really close up the space for the kind of journalism that I think we need.
If there is a First Amendment defense to these charges, what should, is it an absolute defense, or should it, is there some other standard that you would recommend? I start with you, Amy, maybe, if you have any thoughts on what that should look like. You're free to come up with anything you want.
I'm sure Barry has some much better ideas than I've had the time to think about. So,
you want to start?
Yeah.
I mean, if I were designing the system from scratch, then I think I would draw a line between leakers and publishers, even with respect to leakers. And with respect to publishers, I would say, essentially, you know, use your judgment. But once you have the information, you know, the government has lost its authority to keep it secret. With respect to leakers, I would create a public interest defense. In most instances, I think the government has a strong justification for preventing its own employees from disclosing sensitive information, but not in all circumstances. The problem with our system now is that the public interest plays no role. I mean, you know this better than anyone, but the public interest plays no role in deciding whether a prosecution of a leaker is justified or not. The government can prosecute a leaker without reference to whether the disclosure resulted in social benefits.
You want to follow up?
Yeah,
on
no,
that?
I think that's right. I mean, fundamentally, what's missing in what we call national security law, and it's only recently that we started calling it national security law. I mean, even when we were in law school in the 1990s, there were not really courses in national security law. This is a sort of post 9/11 creation, and it's a fancy word for saying the government wins. that we have no room for proportionality analysis in U.S. national security law. And that's not actually true if you look around the world. If you look at Supreme Courts in Europe and Israel and places, they really are sort of grappling with how do we balance these. You know, the government comes in and says, if this happens, it will harm national security. And the judges say, okay, fine. You're the experts in security, but we're the experts in proportionality, and we're going to balance that against the public's need to know, against human rights, and then we're going to try to figure out a way to work through this. In the U.S., when national security is invoked, when secrecy is invoked, it's basically an on-off switch. In a civil case, if it's the state secrets privilege, usually the claim gets thrown out. In a FOIA case, you don't get the document. In these kinds of cases, there's no defense based on you know, the information, the disclosure being strongly in the public interest. So we need to find, again, not just a language in the law, but a language in our discourse around national security for figuring out what do we do
when you have multiple genuine interests at stake. And let's concede that the government has an interest in self-defense, and we all have an interest in self-government. And sometimes those interests are both going to be at their apex at the same time. The government secrecy interest might be the strongest in war, but the public's need to know is also the strongest in war. And so what do you do? How do you analyze these? And it can't be that that one drop of national security is all you need in order to wipe out every interest that we have. And I would actually say there's a constitutional dimension to that, but how that plays out in First Amendment jurisprudence is anybody's guess. And the other thing that we should say, right, is that, you know, none of us are particularly excited with the prospect of these issues being worked out in the prosecution of Julian Assange, given the amount of hostility towards him among prosecutors, judges, and the public in general. You know, this isn't the case where we would want to have these important precedents getting set.
Absolutely. I think that's why we had such a good result in the Pentagon Papers case, because the facts were so favorable for the press. I think we're going to take questions now from the audience.
There is a microphone.
Yep, there is a microphone, so please let the microphone come to you. Anyone has a question for these great panelists?
Hey, Matt Zapatosky from The Washington Post. I wonder if you could talk about what you think Assange's defense will look like, not like what it should look like, and what aspect of it will be the First Amendment. And I also wonder, to your last point, is there any chance that this case would set sort of a what you guys see as a positive precedent for journalism? I mean, is it possible that appellate courts or other courts would look at this and say, hey, the circumstances are such that you're essentially criminalizing journalism and we're gonna step in and narrow the Espionage Act or do something, you know, like they've done on public corruption laws recently?
Who's first? So I just want to speak on the extradition point, because I actually think that is a place where there could be an important precedent that protects journalists and sources. It is not far-fetched to think that the UK courts will step in and say that these are political offenses. They're offenses against the state and not against the public. These are not extraditable. So someone who is brought up on these kinds of charges, whether it's Assange, if you could imagine an extradition proceeding involving a Snowden or another journalist somewhere, that may, in fact, it may be that the government's overreach in adding the Espionage Act charges before the extradition will result in a precedent that will protect investigative journalism at the global level, you know, in the sense that we'll have a strong, you know, precedent around extradition. We do have... this is the, you know, Annie Hall, Marshall McLuhan moment. We actually have Julian Assange's lawyer in the room, so rather than having us speculate on what his defense would look like, I'm going to let you talk to Barry Pollack after this event.
I wonder if a court might try to craft a very narrow decision, so I don't have a ton of optimism for a great decision for the press, just given for the reasons Ben mentioned, but the best we could hope for would be a very narrow decision, I think. Or the best would be not for him not to get extradited. That's the best. And then,
yeah, I mean, one question is how American media organizations would deal with this prosecution if Assange were actually extradited, right? Because there, on the one hand, I think national security journalists really do feel like this indictment describes the work that they do, or comes very close to describing the work that they do. On the other hand, everybody wants to distance themselves from Julian Assange and say, you know, what we do is different from what the government is prosecuting here. And so, you know, if Assange were actually indicted, I think an important question is, or extradited, an important question is, you know, how would American media organizations talk about the case? That might have an influence on the courts. You know, if American media organizations say this case doesn't involve what we do, then I think the chances that we get a negative precedent are higher. On the other hand, if American media organizations say, you know what, this is a little bit like what we do every day, then maybe the courts would see the implications of a negative decision in a different, you know, in a different way.
My name's Jeff Scott. I'm a tourist from North Carolina.
Yes. Welcome.
I was hoping you could talk about the treatment or mistreatment of Assange in prison now, and whether or not you've heard about the special administrative, I'm trying to remember, it's the acronym is SAM, special administrative treatment that he's getting, measures, special administrative measures, and whether or not this is a form of rendition, perhaps, in slow motion?
I don't know that anybody on this panel is actually familiar with the granular details of the treatment. Special administrative measures, you know, I'm familiar with them in the U.S. prison context. I don't even know if that's a term that's used in the U.K., but maybe Barry, who's in the front row, knows more about this, has been more in touch with the legal team and can answer you afterwards.
Thank you. I first want to thank the Courage Foundation for hosting this event. I think it's so important that we do talk about this. And I do want to ask you all a question about how the New York Times and The Guardian both published the same information that Julian Assange and his staff had published through WikiLeaks. They are not facing any criminal charges. However, I do want to be clear that I am not in favor of them being charged, of course. I'm not. However, I find it peculiar that one publisher is being charged, another is not. And also, I want to take this moment to condemn the American corporate media's failure to talk about this case and their misreporting on this case, and for their smears and for repeating CIA talking points about Julian Assange. Free Assange.
One of you pointed out earlier that the indictment was pretty specific about which pieces of information it was charging, and I think DOJ highlighted that in its press release, and I don't know that the Washington Post or the Guardian, I think is the one you mentioned, or the Times published those specific pieces of information. I don't know the facts well enough, but I'm not sure they did. And Jamil made the point earlier that no one else published the names of sources that were endangered by the release. I think those would be the arguments.
That's related to that, and I can't prove
Wait for the microphone.
I can't prove this, but you know, there's a lot of misinformation going around. So this issue of somehow Julian Assange not redacting information and other sources redacting, my understanding, and again, I can't prove it, but in the Laura Petraeus documentary of Julian Assange, which was not a Julian Assange, not a pro-Julian Assange film, it seemed to indicate that actually it was The Guardian that published the non-redacted points, that Julian Assange was actually, WikiLeaks was trying to go through the process of redacting it. And actually there's a scene where Julian Assange tries to reach Secretary of State Clinton, who was at the time, to tell them that this was going out and that they could take whatever measures they would like to protect their people. Of course, she didn't come to the phone. And then they said, well, like, we can't help you with your problem. He said, I actually don't have a problem. You have a problem. So I think I'm correct on that point. So I guess there's a lot of misinformation going out there, and people are entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. So,
yeah, there's a great article by Yochai Benkler from Harvard on WikiLeaks and trying to clear up exactly those kinds of misconceptions.
The irony is that the the publication that he is charged for is the one where they attempted to be most careful involving redactions, had in fact reached out to the State Department, and many of the publications that they're not being charged for are when they very publicly changed their position on redactions, and their now position is that pristine data sets should be published and shouldn't be tampered with at all. But you're certainly right that there's a factual dispute about whether it was the Guardian reporter or Assange that was responsible for publication of the unredacted Afghan war logs.
Any more questions?
Hi. I wonder how much intent matters in cases like this. Just, I think about, you guys probably remember back during the Gulf War, Geraldo Rivera on Fox News was embedded and, you know, drew a map in the sand and saying, you know, we're embedded here and the Marines are over here. And, you know, this is revealing really, really sensitive top secret information during a hot war that could have been very useful, you know, to the enemy. But, would, of course, was never prosecuted. You know, I mean, it was a mistake, no harm, no foul, or whatever. Now, when it comes to the Assange case, his intent obviously is not to provide, you know, aid and comfort to any, you know, enemy of the United States. It's to tell the American people what their government is doing, right? And I wonder, I mean, if you're going to, does that distinction make sense? I mean, if they're going to prosecute Assange, I mean, should they have prosecuted Geraldo Rivera, right? I mean, if you can...
So it's a very good question. Is intent one of the ways that the sort of the First Amendment could impose a narrowing of the strict liability of the Espionage Act, particularly as it relates to a secondary disclosure like Assange? It's pretty clear that there's strict liability for the leaker, you know, here for Manning. In the AIPAC case that was mentioned before, which is the only prosecution that I'm aware of where the government went after not just the initial leak, the State Department officials who leaked to AIPAC, but also the AIPAC lobbyist who then passed on information, I think, to Israeli officials. Judge Ellis in the Eastern District did say that for that secondary disclosure, we're not going to do what Jamil says, which is to say that the government can't prosecute it at all, that once the cat is out of the bag, the government can't do any prosecution. But we are going to say that there has to be an intent to harm national security in order to extend the liability of the act there. Now, we don't know how that case would have played out because the government ended up dropping that prosecution before that law could develop.
One of my partners defended that case, so let me just say
yes.
That proves the government doesn't always win, Ben. So.
Right. In that case, the government didn't win because it decided that it would rather drop the case than submit high officials to discovery and deposition.
And didn't the Fourth Circuit later throw cold water on this intent theory?
Right. I mean, I don't think that is the law right now, but that is, if you were thinking about how to narrow what we all think is too broad, intent would be one place to do that.
You know, I'll point out in New York Times v. Sullivan, one of the best decisions ever, the Supreme Court took the common law of defamation and imposed an intent requirement of actual malice, of knowing falsehood or reckless indifference. So there's certainly some precedent where the court has imposed an intent standard, so certainly within the realm of possibility. We're going to take one more question, and then the panelists will be available afterwards.
You mentioned that, you know, one of the things that Assange is being charged with publishing that the mainstream media didn't publish was the human sources, the names of human sources. Well, you know, there's 17 indictments. So, what are some other examples that I'm curious?
That's just in the indictment, and let me just say, I don't know the facts. I just know what's in the indictment. But sources. War plans, then there's a big, very general category of State Department cables. So there's actually a lot that is charged in the indictment. But human sources, I think, is a particularly sensitive example.
Can you share some other examples, you know, in those?
You can read the indictment. It's available publicly.
I did. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm passing.
Yeah.
Just some specific examples. Like
the human sources is such a specific example.
War plans was another that I remember. But I'm not in a position to tell you what the underlying information was.
All right.
Sorry,
oh, okay.
Ada Fuller
ahead.
Here, Courage Foundation. WikiLeaks Editor-in-Chief Christian Raftensen actually had a peek at the government's affidavit in court recently and said that the government intends to argue that as a foreign national, Julian Assange does not get First Amendment protections. I'm wondering is there a discrepancy between that interpretation and the U.S. saying that the Espionage Act does apply beyond U.S. borders?
Yes. Yeah. But it would not be the first time that the U.S. government had argued that U.S. criminal law applied overseas, but constitutional rights don't apply to the defendants. I mean, that's essentially what the government argued at Guantanamo as well. So,
right, yeah. And in a Fourth Amendment case where the U.S. kidnapped a Mexican national and brought him back to the U.S. for prosecution, and, you know, the four justices in dissent said, if you were going to actually bring the person into our jurisdiction, you should be bringing the Constitution with you. Five justices didn't agree with that in the Fourth Amendment context, but, I mean, certainly our argument would be
you know, as an initial matter, the long arm shouldn't even attach to this conduct, but if it does, the Constitution surely does as well.
But yeah, on this particular point, I guess I would be surprised if Assange were actually extradited and tried here. I'd be surprised if the courts held that the First Amendment were irrelevant to the prosecution. Yeah. I could see the prosecution going, you know, badly for civil liberties in many other ways, but on that one, you know, I think that the courts would look to the First Amendment to determine, you know, what protection Assange is entitled to.
Great. I'd like us all to thank our wonderful panelists for coming tonight. Thank you.